Kane squirmed and wriggled through the forest of fallen rafters and planks. The barrel of his copperhead was jammed tight between two boards. He tugged at it, then let the weapon go. Thankfully, instead of inflicting any damage, the sledgehammer blows knocked him through the barricade. His vision blurred, Kane hitched around and dug into his war bag. His hand closed around another Alcatex, and his thumb flipped away the pin. He flung the Gren behind him, not really seeing where it landed and not caring. Dragging himself to his feet, Kane glanced behind him at the roiling cloud of dust. He dared not open up with his blaster blindly for fear of hitting either Bridget or Domi. The swirl of plaster dust and wood particles convulsed and lit up with dancing spear points of flame. Like a blood-mad berserker, a mag plunged through it, the ejector port of his blaster spraying empty cartridges in a clinking rain. Kane backpedaled as fast as his legs and throbbing torso would allow. Kane wheeled and raced down the hallway, enduring the spasms of pain igniting in his back and chest. A storm of shots continued to follow him. When he came abreast of the first open door, he hurled his body through it, kicking his way through the detritus of two centuries. He entered a small kitchen and vaulted over a countertop, searching for another way out. A swift look around showed him the foot of a staircase, and he bounded to it. He took the steps three at a time, his left hand pressing lightly against the wall for balance. He knew he was being reckless. He reached a landing, paused, and saw a door hanging askew on one hinge a dozen yards down the hall. He rushed for it. As he ran, the floorboards gave way under his weight. As he plunged into blackness, he slapped his hands around a thick strip of ornamental molding running between the floor and the wall. He managed to insert his fingers into the narrow crack between it and the floor. Kane kicked out with his legs, seeking purchase for his feet. The toes of his boots struck an interior crossbrace, and for a moment he was able to relieve some of the tendon-tearing pain in his hands and wrists. Muscles quivering with the strain, he pulled his body up to chin level with the edge of the hole. Desperately, he muscled himself upward. All feeling drained from his fingers, but he managed to get his elbows atop the sheared-away floorboards. With a frantic heave, Kane dragged his body clear of the opening. If he hadn't been wearing armor, his belly and chest would have been severely lacerated. More of the flooring broke away, but he lunged and rolled into the hallway. Staggering to his feet, he ran to the door. He entered a small room cluttered with the remnants of mops, buckets, and push brooms. Metal, ladder-like stairs climbed the far wall, leading to a square wooden hatch in the ceiling. Kane swarmed up the rungs and thrust the trapdoor aside. The ladder extended up a square shaft to the cupola housing the bell tower. To his right was the faint gleam of aluminum air conditioning ductwork inside the maintenance accessway, elevated mere inches above the ceiling panel by rafters and supported by wooden chocks. Kane briefly inspected the interlocking ceiling panels, then he climbed into the crawlspace. There were small cross pieces of 2x4s joining heavy rafters. He crawled along these, putting his weight on the wood. He stretched out on a rafter and carefully tugged aside a corner of a panel. As Kane had figured, the pursuing magistrate had jumped over the gaping hole in the floor and was almost directly below his position. Kane inserted the barrel of his Sin-Eater into the small space between the tiles. He made sure his body was shielded by the rafter before he squeezed the trigger. He withdrew the blaster and shifted position. He slid back, weathering the storm of bullets that chewed up the panels only a few inches below him. Clinging to the rafter with one arm, Kane kicked out several bullet-blasted panels and swung down, hanging above the floor. The mag was running down the corridor, back toward the stairwell. Kane leveled his pistol, preparing to shoot, when the mag paused at the edge of the split in the floorboards. Then the entire building seemed to jump up several inches before sinking. Smoldering wreckage spouted up the stairway. The weak floorboard split beneath the magistrate to let out spurts of smoke and flame. Then the entire floor collapsed. The mag plunged feet first into smoke-spewing darkness. Kane clung to the rafter tightly. The Gren had virtually annihilated the lower section. He wondered who had been responsible for tossing a Gren into the building, and with a stab of anxiety, he hoped Bridget and Domi weren't still hunkered down by the doorway. Dust and smoke from the explosion whirled up in a great pall. Kane pulled himself up into the crawlspace and squirmed back to the ladder in the small room. He could not go down, so he went up, climbing to the open cupola. Looking down into the courtyard below, he saw bodies strewed across the flagstones, lying twisted in pools of blood and body parts. Most of them were magistrates. Because of the smoke, he could not see much, but he did spot a couple of Tigers of Heaven. Bridget, Domi, and Grant were nowhere within his range of vision. Kane peered through the trapdoor. A black-armored figure was climbing the ladder, doing his utmost to be stealthy. His head turned from side to side, and Kane caught the blaze of wild, panicked eyes. Pollard grasped the splintery 2x4 in his right hand, and it shook with the intensity of his emotion. His Sin-Eater was snugged in its holster, and since Kane didn't see his copperhead, he guessed the man had expended all the ammo for both blasters. He had evidently lost his combat knife somewhere as well. Kane crept to the opposite side of the bell tower, walking on the balls of his feet. He crouched in a smear of shadow and waited until Pollard's bulky body pushed through the hatch. He cautiously moved to the open side of the cupola and peered out. As he stared into the courtyard below, his blunt-featured face contorted in a mask of horror. Kane stepped closer to him. Pollard whirled. He held the length of wood in a two-fisted grip. Blood streamed from a shallow cut on his forehead, bisected by the bridge of his nose. He squinted in Kane's direction, and although he made out the mag armor, he didn't relax.
Don't move. What are you doing up here? What the fuck is your name?
Take a guess. Down to only a stick, Polly?
Kane?
One and the same. I haven't seen you since that little field trip of yours into the darks. How was your stroll back to Cobaltville? I don't imagine Abrams helped you make good time, not walking on that lame leg I gave him. You're looking good, though, especially after the way Grant kicked the shit out of you in the admin monolith.
You were there, in the darks?
I was driving the war wag, Polly. Pretty funny when you think about it. Your mission was to find me and Grant, and there we were, right within arm's length all the time. And you were too donkey shit dumb to know it.
Pollard dropped the 2x4 and charged Kane headlong. Kane waited for his attack with lips creased in a tight smile. Kane stepped close and delivered a double hammer blow to Pollard's face. The man locked his arms around Kane's body, pinioning him. Pollard's arms were like steel bands, and despite his armor, pain shot up and down Kane's spine. The magistrate rammed the crown of his head savagely against Kane's chin.
They told me you were dead!
Kane jabbed his thumbs into the sides of Pollard's neck, seeking out the nerve centers. But all of Pollard's tendons and muscles were tense with the fury of his intention to snap Kane's spine. He tried gouging for the man's eyes, but he ducked his head, pressing his face against Kane's breastplate, forcing his upper body to bend over his encircling arms. Despite the armor, Kane knew Pollard's fury-fueled strength could break his back. Although tempted, Kane did not shoot him. Instead, he used the barrel of his Sin-Eater as a bludgeon, clubbing and battering the back of Pollard's skull. Caught in the grip of insane bloodlust, Pollard did not react to the crashing blows. Kane allowed his legs to go slack and limp. He let every ounce of his 180 pounds sag upon Pollard's arms. The man stumbled forward, thrown off balance by the sudden, unexpected dead weight. They lurched drunkenly across the bell tower, and his grip loosened. Kane turned, strained, kicked, and fought his way out of Pollard's murderous embrace. Pollard could have stiff-armed Kane through the open wall, but he showed no interest in escaping. He was intent only upon killing him. He flung himself upon Kane and seized his throat, squeezing as if wringing out a towel. He pressed with his thumbs against his larynx. Kane did not waste time trying to pry the man's fingers off his neck. He had always known Pollard was an exceptionally strong man, but now his murderous hatred had pumped up his strength to superhuman levels. Falling backward with Pollard atop him, Kane doubled up his knees and planted his feet against the man's midsection. He straightened his legs like steel springs. The soles of his boots pushed solidly against Pollard's belly and propelled him up. The man flew backward, his stranglehold broken. Pollard staggered the length of the cupola, his arms windmilling wildly. The backs of his thighs struck a dry-rotted wooden sill, and it crumbled beneath his weight. Kane reeled to his feet, lunging out to grab him. Arms and legs flailing and flopping like those of a stringless puppet, he plummeted straight down to the floor of the courtyard some 50 feet below. A puff of grit-laden dust mushroomed up around his polycarbonate-enclosed body. Kane watched as Pollard stirred fitfully. His twitchings reminded Kane of those made by the muti scorpion when his black carapace had been crushed. That memory seemed a year old now. He saw Bridget, Domi, and Grant surround Pollard's body. They looked up and saw him, and Domi raised her combat master. Kane brought his index finger to his nose and snapped it away to let them know the armored man in the bell tower was him. Bridget knelt beside Pollard, peeled back an eyelid, and tilted her head back, turning her face toward Kane.
If you want to question him, Kane, I suggest you do so soon.
Kane's companions were uninjured, although Grant suffered various bruises. The same could not be said for the Tigers. Jazure was dead, killed by none other than Pollard. Ibici had a gunshot wound to his leg, which would impede their travel back to Port Morninglight. Only a few magistrates remained essentially unhurt. Several of the wounded would die of their injuries before dawn. Their former prisoners were in no rush to put them out of their misery. In fact, they preferred to prolong it. They would make sure the killers of their friends and family felt every second of agony before they died. If not for Grant and Bridget, the people of Port Morning Light would have dragged Pollard down into the swimming pool to be tortured. They had joyfully transformed their holding pen to a torture pit, using knives given to them by the Tigers. Bridget and Grant kneeled protectively on either side of Pollard, with Kiyomasa and Shizuka hovering just within reach of their katanas. Kiyomasa's posture in particular put Kane in mind of a ravening tiger straining at a leash. He glimpsed Domi standing at the rim of the pool, apparently taking a keen clinical interest in the bloody proceedings going on below. Pollard was conscious, but just barely. Despite the measure of protection provided by his armor, many bones in his body had been broken, and he suffered from internal injuries. His ugly face was white and glistening with sweat. Bridget tipped a canteen over his mouth, moistening his lips. When Kane leaned over him, his eyelids fluttered.
Unlucky bastard to the last.
Kane took off his helmet and squatted beside him.
That's probably the truest thing you've ever said, Polly.
I wouldn't be in your boots. Not when the Baron gets hold of you.
Now that you've brought him up, why did he order you into Baron Snakefish's territory?
How'd you know about that? Preservationist spies in the division.
Yeah, that's right. Preservationist spies. Why are you taking prisoners here? Where are you taking them, Koboldville?
Hurt too much to think. Give me something.
Although they had left the medical kit behind in the riverbed, part of the stranded complement of MAG equipment were items to practice field medicine. Grant took a small squeeze hypodermic from a pouch on his belt. It contained a pain reliever and metabolic stabilizer developed by the medics at the MAG division. He undid the seals on Pollard's left gauntlet, tugged it off, and injected the ampoule's liquid contents into the vein of the man's upper wrist. All of them saw the string of digits written in blue ink on his flesh, though a couple of the numbers were blurred due to perspiration. Eyes narrowing, Bridget pulled up the sleeve of his Kevlar undergarment so she could see the entire sequence.
What are those numbers?
He spit a glob of bright pink frothy saliva on the flagstones. None of them said anything, but they knew by the color of the sputum that the man's lungs were punctured.
What do you think those numbers are, whore?
Kane's eyes flashed in anger, and he reflexively drew back his hand to cuff Pollard's face. Although her lips were compressed, Bridget shook her head at him, and he checked the movement. She leaned closer to Pollard's sweat-pebbled face.
I think they're the destination lock codes for a gateway.
Pollard's piggish eyes widened in surprise, a silent affirmation her opinion was correct.
But they don't correspond to the unit in Koboldville, the one in the admin monolith on the Baron's level.
Two lines of concentration appeared on either side of the bridge of her nose. Her lips moved slightly as she impressed the numerical sequence into her eidetic memory.
In fact, they're not the destination access codes to any of the units we've ever used.
So, Polly, when you returned to the redoubt with the prisoners, you weren't going to transport back to Koboldville?
A smile tugged at the corners of Pollard's mouth. The drug coursing through his bloodstream not only masked the pain, but produced a temporary euphoria.
We were, not the slaggers. Gonna send them someplace else, with them numbers.
Why are they written on your arm?
So's I'd remember them, why else?
Yeah, why else?
Where's the location of the unit you were sending the prisoners?
Dunno. Griffin didn't tell me, and I didn't ask.
Griffin? Why would Griffin assign you this mission?
He's the division administrator.
That paper-pushing jack counter? Since when?
Couple 3 months, maybe. Since Abrams was removed, I guess.
Let's get back to the matter at hand. Gossip about the old gang back home can wait.
What were Griffin's specific orders?
Pollard's eyes had acquired a glassy sheen. Bridget dribbled a little more water into his mouth.
What were Griffin's specific orders?
To march to Port Morning Light, round up as many healthy outlanders as we could find and take them prisoner. Chill the rest. Make sure we left nothing to connect Mags to it.
Why? There are plenty of outlanders in Baron Cobalt's own territory.
Maybe there is. Maybe there ain't. Once we marched them back to the redoubt, I was supposed to shove them in that Mattrans thing, input the numbers on my arm on the comp controls and send them someplace. Then we were ordered to return to Cobaltville.
This doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It just might.
Kane.
Kane leaned closer.
Yeah?
Pollard lifted a trembling hand, his forefinger tracing the outline of the red duty badge affixed to Kane's armored chest.
You're a fucking traitor, but you still wear that. How can you live with yourself? Both of you fucking traitors.
Watch your mouth.
What are you gonna do, chill me? I just want to understand you. We served together for years. Flash blasting slaggers and dregs and outlanders. And you threw it all away. And for what?
You wouldn't understand, Polly.
Salvo didn't understand either. Drove him crazy. Then I was told he was working with you all the time. That he was just as much a traitor as you three. Is that true?
No, it wasn't. Salvo wasn't a traitor. He was a scheming, lying sack of shit, a backstabbing murderer, and probably insane, but he wasn't a traitor. I hope that makes you feel better.
It really does. What happened to him?
He's dead.
When?
Kane wasn't inclined to explain how he had shot Salvo atop a Manhattan rooftop on New Year's Eve 2000 in an alternative past timeline. He had lived through the experience and barely understood it himself.
A long, long time ago.
Is that all you know?
Yeah, that's it. I'm just a grunt. Always an unlucky bastard, operating on a need-to-know basis. Just like you used to.
Grant arose swiftly and stalked away, shouldering between Shizuka and Kiyomasa. Shizuka hesitated, then followed him. Kane gazed after Grant, able to guess at the kind of thoughts wheeling through his head. An old guilt returned, making Kane's belly churn with the sickness of self-loathing for a moment. More than a year before, when he had turned against Salvo and broken his lifetime of conditioning, it had resulted in the convictions of Grant and Bridget as his accomplices. He could have dealt with the consequences of his actions if they had landed solely on his shoulders, but he had dragged two good, innocent people into exile with him. There was no way he could ever make it up to them, especially to Grant. He had hoped the man had come to terms with his exile, his criminal status, after all this time. True, the peeling away of their MAG identities had been a gradual process and hard to endure, especially during the first 3 months in Cerberus. Now, when Kane thought of his years as a magistrate, it brought only an ache, a sense of remorse over wasted years. Superficially, Grant had handled his exile better than Kane, but the man was always stoic in the face of physical and emotional pain. Grant had followed Bridget's lead, who was the most adaptable of the three of them, and he seemed devoted to the new work Cerberus offered. But old MAG habits died very hard. Kane managed to push most of them to the back of his mind, storing them with his memories of all the other things that were past, and he wasn't particularly anxious to think about. Except when he collided head-on with a reminder like Pollard. And then they swarmed out like bugs from beneath a lifted rock. Pollard's glazed eyes snapped wide.
Are you gonna let him do that to me?
Why not? You deserve it more than your men. You led them, ordered them.
Just following my own orders, Kane. You know how that is. You haven't forgotten what it's like.
No, I haven't. No matter how much I wish I could. But being a good soldier doesn't justify a massacre.
Chill me yourself, then. Just put your blaster to my head and pull the trigger. Don't let me die like that. It's not right. Not for a magistrate.
Kane gazed down steadily into the man's damp face for a long, contemplative moment. A magistrate is virtuous in the performance of his duty. The panegyric phrase drifted through his mind. The duties and obligations that came with his badge and blaster were drilled into him. All magistrates, for that matter, from the day they first entered the academy. The oath was a part of their every action and reaction, a justification and a reason to live, a moral sword and a shield for the work they performed in service to maintain order, in service to the Baron. And as Kane and Grant learned, in service to a lie, a conspiracy hatched hundreds of years before any of them were born. Kane glanced up into the immobile face of Kiyomasa, then back down at Pollard.
It's not up to me. You killed a man's woman and his child, which she carried. Even if you didn't do it yourself, you commanded it to be done, or you didn't stop it. Someone else will decide how and when you'll die. Not me. If it means anything, I'm sorry.
It doesn't. Fuck you, traitor.
Kane rose to his feet. Brigid glanced toward the pool with slitted eyes, then turned smartly on a heel, marching away into the shadows.
I would be in your debt, Kiyomasa, if you can see your way to stopping the torture.
Torture is not our way either, Kane-san. But the people whom these men abused, whose families they murdered, whose homes they burned, have earned a right to balance the scales.
Kiyomasa hefted his katana.
As have I. Please, do not interfere with what I must do, so the spirits of my woman and baby can rest easily.
Can you at least promise to make Pollard's End swift?
Forgive me, Kane-san, but I can promise nothing of the sort.
Kane stared into the man's expressionless face, as impassive as if it were carved from ivory. He nodded in resignation and turned to walk away to find Brigid. A jarring, stunning blow landed against the back of his head, causing multicolored pinwheels to spin behind Kane's eyes. With his left hand, Kane heaved himself onto his back, his sin-eater slapping into his right palm. Pollard towered over him, one boot lifted as if preparing to stomp the back of his head. Temples throbbing, Kane leveled his blaster, ready to fire. Pollard did not lower his foot. He simply stood there, looking ludicrous while he balanced himself. Then light glittered dully from the flat silver spur projecting from the junction of Pollard's right shoulder and neck. Kiyomasa stood behind him, his face set in a grim mask. He had slid his sword with apparent ease through the armor, flesh, and bones. Kiyomasa then brought his sword high above his head. Pollard dropped to his knees, his intestines streaming out of his body. His eyes were wide, and his mouth worked as if trying to cast one last curse at Kane. Before Kane could climb to his feet, Kiyomasa held Pollard's head aloft by his hair.
Was his end swift enough for you, Kane-san?
Grant strode deliberately out of the confines of the walled courtyard, past the eviscerated and decapitated bodies of several magistrates, and into the surrounding darkness. He was glad when he could no longer taste the chemical tang of lingering CS gas, but he did not stop to take in the fresher air. He continued walking, entering a tangle of undergrowth. The mag he had rendered unconscious lay where Grant had dumped him, his jaws still distended by the makeshift gag. Ambient moonlight gleamed on his terror-wide eyes. Grant reached down for him.
Shut up.
Grant slid his hands under the man's armpits and dragged him to his feet.
I wanted to chill you, I'd have done it 20 minutes ago.
The mag trembled violently, his knees quivering, saliva drooling down his chin from beneath the gag. His face was pallid, drained of all color, his eyelids fluttering like the wings of a crazed butterfly. Spinning him, Grant unsheathed his combat knife and slashed through the nylon cuffs.
I'm not going to hurt you, understand?
The magistrate jerked in reaction. He clawed at his gag, managing to pull it down around his neck.
Think you can find your way back to the installation in the mountains?
The young man did not answer for a moment. His eyes darted from Grant to the direction of the courtyard.
I'm not going to chill you. Can you get back to the redoubt or not?
I think so. Yes, sir.
Then prove it.
Grant gave him a shove out of the thicket. The man stumbled forward and regarded him fearfully over his shoulder. Once again, Grant was struck by how familiar his features seemed.
What's your name, kid?
Mace.
You have a brother in the division?
I had a brother. He's dead over a year ago now.
How?
He was blasted down in Tartarus, trying to arrest terrorists.
Grant managed to conceal his reaction. The man's brother had been in the force of magistrates led by Salvo to apprehend him, Brigid, and Kane. He had always known the furious firefight that ensued had claimed the lives of at least three mags, possibly more.
Get going.
I don't know if I can operate that...
Gateway?
That thing that brought us here. Don't know if I can work it.
If you get back to the redoubt alive and can't figure the gateway out, just wait for me. I'll send you back home.
Thank you, sir.
Grant waited until he disappeared into the gloom and left the tangle of thorns and vines. He removed his helmet and saw with a twinge of anger the tremor in his hands. He told himself it was the after effect of combat, of adrenaline, but he wasn't able to convince himself. He knew on a deep gut level he wasn't just disgusted with the slaughter and the torture, but was also profoundly shaken by it. He had no idea why, In his 20-odd years as a hard-contact magistrate, he had not only witnessed, but also participated in, events of such bloody carnage that even a swampy would have nightmares. A month or so ago, Grant had realized the simplest answer was that he was getting old. Too old to take violence in stride anymore. Too old to simply shove scenes of horror away in a dark, cobwebby corner of his mind. The last 5 years he spent as a magistrate had been fairly routine. He had looked forward to a transfer to a desk-bound administrative position, and the prospect of hanging up his blaster and putting his armor in storage hadn't disquieted him at all. When he sacrificed all of that to join Kane in exile, he had harbored the secret hope, one he'd never spoken of, that his involvement in bloodshed would be minimal. Instead, it was far worse than even his first few years as a mag. The irony weighed on his mind, no matter how many mental tricks he employed to either justify or avoid it. When they first joined the Cerberus Exiles, Grant made an effort to get to know the other personnel. They were brilliant and wayward members of different divisions in other vills, who, through Lakesh's machinations, had first fallen afoul of baronial laws, and then were spirited away by Lakesh, ending up in Cerberus as insurrectionists rather than facing executions. Grant had tried to view them as fellow expatriates, comrades in arms, all joined together to throw off the heel of an oppressor. But the ingrained habits of a lifetime couldn't be cast aside in the course of a year. On occasion, he still thought of his fellow exiles as slaggers, as criminals, and of Lakesh as a dangerous subversive. Shizuka padded up to him, her elaborate helmet tucked under an arm. Her face was begrimed, and on the graceful column of her neck was a speckling of the dried blood of an opponent. She gazed into his face searchingly.
Are you all right, grandson? You don't require medical attention?
As long as I can walk, I'm fine.
Spoken like a true samurai. You fought very well, very bravely.
Thanks, but it's just part of the job.
As did your friends, particularly the little ghost girl.
She tends to get carried away.
Shizuka stepped closer, her penetrating dark eyes fixed unblinkingly on his face.
Is she yours?
No.
So you don't get carried away?
Not like that, I don't.
So that is why you freed one of the killers.
Why didn't you stop him? Mince him up with that super sharp sword of yours.
It was not my place. His life was yours to do with as you willed. The captain may not have approved, but he wouldn't have interfered either.
It's good to learn your samurai code makes some allowances for individual actions, like mercy.
The Otoko no Michi is complex and multifaceted. Do not make snap judgments until you learn more about it and us.
I'd like to learn more about New Edo and about you.
I am of a samurai family. And to learn about me is to learn about New Edo.
I'd like to see it one day.
Perhaps you shall. It is not far off the coast or hard to find. If you know where to look, that is. But like this country, it is torn by disagreement. I fear that after this day's atrocities committed against our allies, the disagreement may explode into actual strife.
Why so?
I should not speak of it. You are a gaijin, an outsider. Yet I feel I can trust you. Captain Kiyomasa and my daimyo, Lord Takaun, disagree about the path the future of New Edo should embark upon. Lord Takaun wishes to remain isolated, as self-sufficient as we can manage.
And Captain Kiyomasa doesn't see it the same way?
He does not. He wishes to expand our influence into the mainland, over this section of the Pacific coast. He seeks trade agreements, mutual non-aggression and protection pacts with settlements. He wants to establish a sovereign colony here.
The barons may have a little something to say about that.
That is Lord Takaun's main objection. Inasmuch as we have precious little intelligence about the military might of your baronies.
I see. I can tell you one thing about them. They won't come at you with World War II vintage long blasters loaded with only one round.
Very true. Our armament is not what you would call state-of-the-art. Not even by the standards of the year of the Holocaust. Ammunition is expensive and hard to come by. We don't have the natural resources to manufacture much of it ourselves.
So why only one bullet per gun?
Actually, only Josure had one bullet. As the poorest marksman, that's all the captain felt he deserved.
Then why didn't he give you a long blaster with a full clip to carry?
Captain Kiyomasa did not feel I was worthy of one.
It's a misconception that an archer's skill can be applied to firearms. Besides, none of us, including the captain, has had sufficient ammunition with which to practice. Our daimyo prefers we hoard it until we face a genuine emergency.
In that case, even if you manage to plant a colony here, the barons will take it away from you and burn you out, just like the mags did to Port Morninglight.
Perhaps. But if we have allies who might be inclined to trade guns, bullets, and training with us...
What can New Edo provide in exchange?
Some of the science and technology that we have revived.
Like how you can hone a blade so sharp it cuts through anything?
Much of that is due to training, but yes, that and much more.
I'm not much on making business deals, especially in circumstances like these. But your proposal has a lot of merit. First, we'd have to see your tech, which means we'd have to visit New Edo.
I'm sure that can be arranged. If we leave at daybreak, we could be back there by this time tomorrow evening.
We've got our own mission to complete.
I presumed you had completed it. You questioned that man Pollard.
And learned damn little. We know what he was doing, but not the why. He didn't know either, so we have to return to our home base and make further plans.
That saddens me, grandson. I looked forward to your visit.
Why?
There is something magnificent in your spirit, grandson. I find it very compatible with my own.
She placed a hand on his cheek. Despite her gloves, her touch was warm and electric.
I know you feel the same way. I see it in your eyes.
Grant's throat constricted to an almost painful degree. He felt his body responding to the woman's proximity. Tentatively, he lifted his left hand and cupped the woman's cheek.
Shizuka.
She raised herself on tiptoes, dropping her helmet. She put her arms around him, one hand at the back of his neck, forcing his head down. Grant bent and touched his lips to hers. She responded hungrily with an urgent, burning passion. Hearing a noise, Grant gently and reluctantly lifted his face from hers and looked around. At first, he saw nothing. Then he detected a movement in a wedge of shadow, a blurred glimpse of a white-haired head.
What is it?
Carefully, Grant disengaged himself from the woman.
I think it's time we get back to the others.
Shizuka picked her helmet up from where she dropped it.
I heard her too. You said that she wasn't yours.
She isn't, but she thinks I'm hers.
Oh.
They started back toward the courtyard, Grant keeping a surreptitious eye out for Domi. Although he knew Shizuka's martial skills were more than adequate to protect her from a wild attack from the girl, he wouldn't have been surprised to find his own throat on the receiving end of her knife blade. Kane had no intention of remaining in the town until the last magistrate was permitted to die. Already two of the former prisoners had inflicted so much torture they were exhausted. They sat on the edge of the pool, tired, disheveled, faces drained, blood-drenched from fingertips to elbows. He wasn't certain what they had done to the mags, but he knew sharpened stakes and knives heated to red hot over a fire played prominent roles. He had no idea of where Grant had disappeared to. Unable to raise him on the comlink, he had sent Domi to find him and fetch him back. He sought out Brigid and found her in a far corner on the opposite side of the courtyard from the pool. She sat on a crumbling concrete bench, looking very wan and not a little sick.
I think we should pull out as soon as possible, Baptiste. It'll be easier to cross the desert at night. The water and concentrated food in the kit will get us back to the redoubt if we ration them. If you feel up to it, that is.
Oh, I'm up to it. We've learned all we're likely to learn here.
Which is precisely shit.
That's not quite so.
Explain.
I can only speculate and extrapolate, but given what we know of Baron Cobalt's activities over the past few months, I think he's more concerned with saving himself than maintaining the oligarchy as a whole.
I'm not going to argue about that. So, what do you think? Since we made the Dulce facility useless to the Barons, Cobalt is scrambling around trying to find fresh genetic material only for himself?
Exactly. In my opinion, he's preoccupied with consolidating his power base. And in order to do that, he has to stay healthy.
Well, that may explain why he never sent another mag squad into the Darks to avenge Abrams' defeat. Revenge is taking a back seat to plain old survival.
More than that, certainly he needs to sustain himself, just like all the other barons, but it's possible he's doing so at the expense of his brother barons. He may be waiting for them to sicken and start dying off so he can conquer their vills.
Maybe. But making ambitious moves like that is a pretty blasphemous thing for a Baron to do. He'd be spitting not only on the unification program, but on the Archon Directorate itself. One of the reasons the Barons have observed a balance of power for so long is their fear that the Archons will get pissed and blow the world up again.
I know. But that presupposes the Barons, or Kobold at least, actually believe in the Archon Directorate anymore. Perhaps they never did.
Well, for the sake of argument, let's say Baron Kobold is doing what you say. But where is he processing the raw genetic material for his own private treatments? We know it's not the anthill, and it's for damn sure not that Nazi pest hole in Antarctica. None of the Vills have the necessary kind of medical facilities or know-how to perform the advanced genetic therapy the Barons need to stay alive. Only Dulce had that.
The gateway codes Pollard had on him are probably the answer.
I suppose we can input them into the controls when we get back to Redoubt Charlie and see where we end up.
And maybe jump into a platoon of mags or a nest of hybrids. Use your head, Kane.
What's your suggestion, then?
Once we've returned to Cerberus, I'll see if I can match up the code with the index in the Cerberus network database. If we have a redoubt designation, we'll have a location and an idea of what to expect there. That's what I suggest. A modicum of preliminary investigation and planning.
Kane realized he couldn't argue with her reasoned response, and he felt slightly embarrassed. Bridget rubbed the sides of her head.
The head hurt?
Like hell. But it's controllable. DeForest said I was likely to experience headaches for a couple of months, particularly after periods of exertion. It'll pass.
I tried to get you to sit this op out.
I've been convalescing long enough.
Once again, he silently marveled at Bridget Baptiste's stamina. She was one of the toughest people he had ever met. For a woman who had been trained to be an academic, a scholar, and had never strayed more than 10 miles from the sheltering walls of Cobaltville, her resiliency and resourcefulness never failed to impress him. Over the past year, she had left her tracks in the most distant and alien of climes and made her way through very deep, very dangerous waters. Both of them had come a long way, in distances that could not be measured in mere miles, from the night of their first meeting in the residential enclaves. Kane gazed across the courtyard where the Tigers of Heaven prepared a litter for the wounded Ibici.
What do you think of our new friends? Pretty amazing how their swords cut through armor.
They've probably laser-sharpened the edges to only a few molecules thick. It's an old technique. Besides, don't you think it's a little premature to call them friends?
They helped us.
Only because we could help them. Pretty much an alliance of convenience all the way around.
Sometimes that's how friendships are forged. I think you and I are the perfect examples of that.
Whatever you say, Kane.
Bridget smiled for the first time since they entered the ruins of the town, a lopsided lifting of a corner of her mouth. Domi reappeared, stalking with a stiff-legged stride through the entranceway arch.
Welcome back.
Bite me!
Hey, did you find him?
She didn't answer or even deign to look in his direction. She only gestured behind her, a snapping, almost dismissive wave of one arm.
What the hell is going on with her now?
Grant then entered the courtyard with Shizuka at his side. Bridget nodded toward them.
You should probably ask them.
Oh.
Kane pushed himself to his feet and crossed the courtyard to meet the pair. Bridget followed a moment later.
We're ready to move out, Grant.
No? A night march?
Why not? Easier to walk at night wearing this armor than in the heat of the day.
What about the stuff we left in the riverbed?
Leave it. I don't feel like backtracking, especially through the field of snakes again.
I guess crossing the desert at night makes sense.
Kiyomasa walked over to them. His foul humor over having to kill Pollard quickly, rather than making him eat his own testicles, followed by having red-hot coals shoved into his mouth, seemed to have disappeared.
We thank you for your help in bringing these murderers to judgment, and for rescuing our friends from slavery.
Our pleasure.
Nueda would be most interested in striking an official alliance with you and the powers you represent, Kane-san. Now that you are aware of our existence, perhaps we may be of some service to each other in the future.
I was thinking along much the same lines, but how do we reach Nuedo?
From inside his breastplate, Kiyomasa produced a folded square of yellow parchment and handed it to Bridget.
These are the longitudinal coordinates of our island. It is in Japanese, but I'm sure you can translate the ideograms, since you show such a facility with our language.
Domo arigato.
All of the Tigers of Heaven assembled around the three Outlanders, Ibici included, leaning on a crutch made from a piece of broken rafter. They bowed deeply. Domi wasn't interested in taking part in the formal farewells. She had already stalked back to the courtyard entrance and stood beneath the arch, her eyes snapping with impatience. Shizuka leaned toward Grant.
If the winds of fate wish it to be so, they will blow us back to each other very soon.
The winds of fate.
Grant cast a sideways glance toward Domi, making sure both her blaster and her knife were securely leathered.
Among other things.
Front Royal, a villa in Virginia, was not greatly changed since the time of the inaugural Council of Front Royal nearly a century before. Siege damage to the villa had been repaired long ago, restoring its former appearance of a medieval castle. The towers and turrets and observation areas overlooked a wide green valley. The weathered bricks and blocks were clean of vines and lichens. The main building, the keep, rose above the walls in a defiant thrust of chiseled stone, stained glass windows, and forged steel. The ville was enclosed by walls nearly 50 feet tall, offering flat buttresses of impregnable fortifications. The walls, in turn, were surrounded by a river with only a single bridge that crossed it into a central cobblestone plaza. As one of the concessions to modern times, powerful halogen spotlights were mounted both on the walls and atop the turrets. Projecting from each corner of the walls were Vulcan Phalanx gun towers, the heavy weapons ready and waiting to fend off any sort of attack. Front Royal was not occupied except by a skeleton maintenance staff and a garrison consisting of 20 soldiers. It was not a ville in the conventional sense, but more of a neutral zone, a place where the barons could meet on equal terms. It was the birthplace of the program of unification when the 9 most powerful barons from across the Deathlands put aside their differences and regional jealousies in order to consolidate their collective strength and unite the nation under their control. A mysterious emissary named Thrush issued an ultimatum to the barons. Either they would agree to the principles of the unification program, or they would face devastation on a scale unrivaled since the nuke cost. In exchange for their agreement, the barons would have access to pre-dark technology and techniques of social engineering that would further extend their control over an unsuspecting populace. In Erica Van Sloan's opinion, Front Royal was not much of a substitute for the pre-Skydark Camp David. That the barons preferred to maintain its quaint old-world architecture, as fake as it was, in lieu of redesigning it to resemble the administrative monoliths in the villas, was not much of an improvement. The main hall of the keep was immense. Its heavy-beamed ceiling and waxed oak-paneled walls always danced with the light of 100 false electric candles in the wrought-iron chandelier. The floor was of polished marble in swirling, indefinable patterns. At the far end was a hearth big enough to comfortably sleep 4 barons and 2 of the security staff. A yard-long electric log always glowed there. Despite its tasteful furnishings, the place was so obviously faux it almost reached the point of being funny. Erica Van Sloan could not help but be reminded of theme parks built to emulate King Arthur's Camelot or some other place that probably never existed outside of the imagination. As far as she knew, none of the barons objected to the installation of a Mattrans unit within a shielded cubicle, complete with stripped-down control room, on the opposite side of the main hall. Erica did not think the 6-sided elevated chamber with its sky-blue armorglass walls added or detracted from the old-world feel of the big room. It simply stood there, at the far end of the control room, like an ugly conversation piece. Sitting in her wheelchair in the control room, she tensed, or made an attempt to. The Mattrans unit cycled through another materialization. She didn't bother trying to make out the vague shape shifting on the other side of the translucent armorglass shielding. She knew who would be standing there within the walls, and so she saw no need to sit and wait for the delegates to arrive one by one. She was sure the matter stream and destination codes were locked on their automatic settings. Erica turned her wheelchair from the comp station and rolled toward the conference room. She resolutely avoided looking in the direction of the monitor screens, glass-encased control boards, or anything that might reflect her appearance. Behind her, the chamber's door swung open on counterbalanced hinges. She knew mist swirled thickly within the thready static electricity discharges arcing within the billowing mass. The mist was simply a byproduct of the quantum interface, a plasma waveform that only resembled vapor. Born in 1974 by the old calendar, Erica Van Sloan still viewed the matter transfer machines more akin to magic than science, like leftover props from the science fiction films and TV shows she had enjoyed as a child. Unlike similar devices in celluloid fiction, the gateway units had never been responsible for ghastly accidents like transposing a human subject's head on the body of a fly or splitting a man into his positive and negative halves, at least as far as she knew. She really didn't know the entire history of the quantum interface Matrans inducers, despite being assigned to Operation Kronos, the sister subdivision of Project Cerberus. As a cybernetic specialist, she understood in theory how the quantum energies released by the gateways transformed organic and inorganic matter to digital information, transmitted it along a hyperdimensional pathway, and reassembled it in a receiver unit. To accomplish this, the Matrans units required an inestimable number of maddeningly intricate electronic procedures, all occurring within milliseconds of one another to minimize the margins for error. The actual matter-to-energy conversion process was sequenced by an array of computers and microprocessors, with a number of separate but overlapping operational cycles. The wheelchair turned right. As per the established policy, she encountered no one else. All of the servants and guards were forbidden to enter the bottom level of the keep, particularly when the barons were present. Erica entered a room that seemed to stretch for a mile. The floor, the walls, the ceiling, all were made of a slick, slightly reflective vanadium alloy. Not only was the sheathing for security purposes, but also it provided protection just in case a roamer or a preservationist, or even Kanan Grant, fired a law rocket at the keep. At the far end was a conference table, a highly polished 12-foot diameter oval of rare and expensive teak. Erica rolled past the 9 chairs around the table, noting expressionlessly that one of the chairs would remain vacant. Her chair stopped near the head of the table, where she waited and remembered. Dr. Erica Van Sloan was of half Latino and half British extraction. She had inherited her dark hair and eyes from her Brazilian mother, but she possessed her father's tall frame and long, solid legs. God only knew from which side of her family her 200-point IQ derived, but she knew she received her beautiful singing voice from her mother. At 18 years of age, the haughty, beautiful, and more than a trifle arrogant Erica earned her PhD in cybernetics and computer science. She wanted to pursue a singing career, but within days of her graduation from Caltech, she went to work for a major Silicon Valley hardware producer as a models and systems analyst. 8 months later, she left her six-figure annual salary to accept a position with a government-sponsored ultra-top-secret undertaking known as Overproject Whisper. Only much later did she realize Whisper was a major division of something called the Totality Concept, and she was assigned to one of its subdivisions, Operation Kronos. In the vast installation beneath a mesa in Dulce, New Mexico, she served as the subordinate, lover, and occasional victim of a man who made her own officious personality seem mousy and shy by comparison. Torrance Silas Burr was brilliant, stylish, waspish, and nasty. He excelled at using his enormous intellect and equally enormous ego to fuel his cruel sense of humor. He delighted in belittling and degrading not just her, but other scientists assigned to Overproject Whisper. The one scientist he could not deride was Mohandas Lakesh Singh, the genius responsible for the final technological breakthrough of Project Cerberus, which permitted Operation Kronos to finally make some headway. Although the Totality Concept projects were rarely coordinated, the techs of Operation Kronos used Lakesh's Matrans discoveries to spin off their own innovations and achieve their own successes. Operation Kronos dealt in the mechanics of time travel, forcing temporal breaches in an attempt to enter probability gaps between one interval of time and another. Inasmuch as Project Cerberus utilized quantum events to reduce organic and inorganic material to digital information and transmit it through hyperdimensional space, Operation Kronos built on that same principle to peep into other timelines and even trawl living matter from the past and the future. Although more than one hapless human being was snatched from the past and brought forward into the present, there had been only one proved success with a trawling subject who arrived in the 20th century sane in mind and sound of body. After many failures, Burr's subdivision successfully retrieved a living subject from a past timeline, a scientist from the 19th century. However, the subject proved so very troublesome, he was finally removed from DULSA. Not too long after that, a series of sweeping policy changes came into play, which created something far beyond the scientific ambitions of the Totality Concept staff. Other government agencies became involved, as well as other countries. With the advent of the Cerberus success, the redoubts were built, linked to each other by gateway units. Though the continuity of government facilities and the redoubt scientific enclaves were not part of the same program, there was an almost continuous trade-off of design specifications, technology, and personnel. Many of the Totality Concept subdivisions and spin-off researches were relocated to COG redoubts. Operation Kronos was moved to Chicago, and Project Cerberus was moved to Montana. The most ambitious COG facility was codenamed the Anthill because of its resemblance in layout to an ant colony. It was a vast complex with a railway, stores, theaters, and even a sports arena. Supplies of foodstuffs, weapons, and anything of value were stockpiled. Because of its size, the Anthill was built inside Mount Rushmore, using tunneling and digging machines. The entire mountain was honeycombed with interconnected levels, passageways, and chambers. Erica learned that once construction on the anthill was completed, the entire Totality Concept program would be moved into it. She could not understand why, and when she had spoken to Burr of her confusion, he spoke cryptically of the jamais vu principle, referring to a time perception disorder. He had spoken darkly of a probability wave dysfunction that Operation Kronos had triggered when it disrupted the Kronon structure. He claimed they had inadvertently created an alternate future scenario for humanity, and it wasn't one he cared to live in. Burr had hinted that the frenzied construction of the redoubts was due to his report of the dysfunction, and if the Totality Concept researches had been left to molder in old military intelligence files at the end of World War II, the alternate future scenario would never have come into existence. There was no stopping it. There was only surviving it, and he wasn't very sanguine about humanity's chances. He had declared vehemently that he had no intention of voluntarily imprisoning himself in the anthill. He would make his own plans, utilizing the jamais vu principle he had created. Erica only saw him once more after that, secretly removing files and computer diskettes from his office. That was Christmas Eve 2000. She could have wished him the season's greetings, or she could have logged in the security violation and had him executed, but by then she was too emotionally wrung out to do either. She did not miss Burr once she arrived in the anthill to begin her new duties. There were far more immediate concerns to attend to than the fate of her former boss and lover, whom she despised anyway. When the world blew out, at noon of January 20th, 2001, she ceased to think about him at all. Like everyone else in the installation, she prayed the safety measures would kick in as they were designed to. But despite all of their precautions, radiation still trickled in. Bomb-triggered earthquakes caused extensive damage. Since the military and government personnel in charge had no choice but to remain in the facility, it took them a while to realize they were just as much victims of the nuke cost as those whom they referred to as the useless eaters of the world. Erica Van Sloan could not help but laugh to herself over the grim irony. She remembered how a fringe movement called survivalism had gained popularity, primarily among ex-military and rural people with various political axes to grind. They trained and indoctrinated themselves so thoroughly to survive Armageddon, some of them actually began to look forward to it. They deluded themselves into believing a post-Holocaust world would be better than the one they lived in. They aspired to have a world where the romance of the frontier spirit would be revived, free of government regulations, laws, and moral obligations, where a human being's worth would be measured only in how willing he or she was to kill a child for a crumb of food. Most of the government people in the anthill viewed survivalists as brain-damaged paranoids. But as the second anniversary of the nuke cost passed, it became patently obvious the men who knew in advance about the atomic megacull were just as stupendously ill-informed as the survivalists at whom they had once sneered. Like their less educated counterparts, they had no real grasp of the scope of the global devastation. None of their painstaking calculations regarding the acceptable losses, destruction ratios, and the length of the nuclear winter bore any resemblance to the terrifying reality. When this select few, this powerful elite, finally did come to terms with reality, it was too late to do much about it. They had assumed that after 5 years or less of waiting inside the anthill, a new world order would be in place. Now, the schedule appeared to be closer to 20 years. Erica recalled how General Kettridge would rant about how they had lied to them, about how they had deceived them. But Kettridge tended to rant and rave at the slightest pretext anyway, so she suppressed her curiosity about the identities of they. The prolonged nuclear winter changed ideas about a new world order. Even if the personnel managed to outlast the big freeze, the Sky Dark, they would still sicken and die, either from radiation sickness or simply old age. So they embarked on a radical and daring plan. Cybernetic technology had made great leaps in the latter part of the 20th century, and Erica herself had made some small contributions to those advances. General Kettridge ordered operations to be performed on everyone living in the anthill, making use of the new techniques in organ transplants and medical technology, as well as in cybernetics. Over a period of years, everyone living inside Mount Rushmore had been turned into cyborgs, hybridizations of human and machine. Radiation-burned flesh was replaced by synthetic skin. Limbs with cancerous marrows were changed out for ones made of plastic, Dacron, and Teflon. With less energy to expend on maintaining the body, the cyborganized subjects ate less and therefore extended the stockpile of foodstuffs by several years. Since the main difficulty in constructing interfaces between mechanical, electric, and organic systems was the wiring, Erica oversaw the implantation of superconducting quantum interface devices, or SQIDs, directly into the brain. 1/100th of a micron across, SQIDs facilitated the subject's control over the new prostheses. Although Erica herself had designed the implants and oversaw the early operations, she certainly did not care for the process being performed on her. She knew that SQIDs could be used to electronically control their subjects, and she wasn't fond of being turned into a biomechanical drone. However, she was even less fond of the alternative, euthanasia. Of course, the transformations did not solve all of the anthill's survival issues. Compensation for the natural aging process of organs and tissues had to be taken into account. The anthill personnel needed a supply of fresh organs, preferably those of young people, but obviously the supply was severely limited. So General Kettridge, now calling himself the Commander-in-Chief, came up with a solution: cryogenics, or a variation thereof. Kettridge was inspired by the method of keeping organic materials fresh by pumping a hermetically sealed vault full of dry nitrogen gas and lowering the temperature to below freezing. He ordered the internal temperatures inside the installation to be lowered just enough to preserve the tissues, but not low enough to damage the organs. Other scientific disciplines were blended. The interior of the entire facility was permeated with low-level electrostatic fields of the same kind hospitals experimented with to maintain the sterility of operating rooms. The form of cryogenesis employed at the installation was not the standard freezing process relying on immersing a subject in liquid nitrogen and the removal of blood and organs. Rather, it utilized a technology that employed a stasis screen tied in with the electrostatic sterilizing fields, which for all intents and purposes turned the anthill complex into an encapsulated deep storage vault. This process created a form of active suspended animation, almost as if the personnel were enclosed by an impenetrable bubble of space and time, slowing to a crawl all metabolic processes. The people achieved a form of immortality, but one completely dependent on technology. Erica never wondered aloud where the stasis technology came from, but she assumed it derived from the mysterious they whom Kettridge accused of betrayal. However, even those measures were temporary. Erica had volunteered to enter a stasis canister for a period of time, to be resurrected at some future date when the sun shone again and the world was secure. When Erica awakened, more than a century had passed. During her long slumber, the anthill installation suffered near catastrophic damage. General Kettridge was killed, and a number of stasis units malfunctioned, including her canister. Due to that malfunction, her squid's device had inflicted neurological damage on her body, and she was resurrected as a cripple. Worse than finding out her long, shapely legs were little more than withered sticks was learning the plans made for her while she slept. Erica was briefed on the program of unification and the baronial oligarchy, and the true identities of Kettridge's They were finally revealed. Or at least, they were given a name. Archons. She was told that to be of optimal use to the Archon Directorate and their hybrid plenipotentiaries, the Barons, she needed to be as fit as possible for a human in her physical condition and chronological age. Moreover, Erica was informed she was only one of several pre-Holocaust humans, known as Freezies in current vernacular, resurrected to serve the Baronies, and she would consider herself fortunate to be among their number. In other words, she was not to grieve, mourn, weep, or otherwise feel sorry for herself. She was to concentrate only on what her technological skills could contribute to the furtherance of the program of unification. Otherwise, she would be put out of her misery. Erica was not assigned to any particular vill for any length of time. She was given quarters in Front Royal, and from there she traveled from barony to barony, setting up their computer systems, training personnel in their operation, and in troubleshooting procedures. The systems, although in absolutely pristine order, were not state-of-the-art, certainly not by the standards of the first year of the 21st century. None of the mainframes employed the biochip developments that would have been commonplace if the nuke cost had been averted. Most of the software, hardware, and support systems were fairly basic as well. Erica could not help but suspect that the truly advanced pre-dark tech was being deliberately suppressed. She could only assume it was done out of fear of the new post-nuke society becoming just as dependent on technology as the old one. Whatever the real reason, she learned quickly not to question. Over the years of Erica's long life, due to the creativity and skills of her intellect, she had undergone many organ transplants so as to extend her value to the United Baronies. Despite the pain and suffering that had accompanied each successive operation, Erica never regained the use of her legs, and the neurological degeneration grew so acute she became a complete cripple. The cost of every one of those years of agony showed in her face, and so she always tried to avert her eyes from a reflective surface, even the highly polished tabletop. Erica had never grown accustomed to the craggy, seamed face staring back at her from mirrors or even windows. Her hair, though still as black as the night, was so thin and straggly she usually wore it pulled back in a tight knot at the nape of her wattled neck. She wore a nondescript gray coverall, which was baggy on her small and scrawny frame. Only her jet-black eyes seemed to show any life, blazing in her deeply lined face, glinting with impatience. Erica was anxious for the session to begin. Since cybernetic principles were applied to management and organizational theory, she always had much to offer in the way of streamlining Vill government. Just as everything that occurred in the universe could be reduced to cause and effect chains, the chains themselves could be used to build organizational models. Now, months after the disaster at the Dulce site, a new model urgently needed to be constructed. And so Erica sat in the council chamber and waited for the Barons to arrive. They needed her input, not simply so they could determine a course of action, but also to stay alive. She was less a moderator of the meeting than a mother figure. Erica repressed a bleak smile and wondered what she would tell them.